Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now program for this second week of January 2017. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and today we will hear part two of an interview that I did about a month or so ago with Jim Bodkin talking about sea otters off Washington's outer coast. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, this is a bit of a trick question, because for the most part, this critter is silent. But occasionally, you can hear this mystery sound. I'll share its identity with you a little later in the program. First, however, Nature Now's multi-talented sound engineer, Charlie Fleischman, will help me share a few natural history observations from around our town.
It certainly has been cold this past week, but that has not stopped some of Port Townsend's avid birders. Artemis Selt spent some time last week birding the Fort Flagler campground beach and the Indian Island Isthmus. She was rewarded with sightings of about 175 brants feeding right next to the shore, 3 dozen black turnstones, 45 dunlin, 40 black-bellied plovers, and numerous other species of waterfowl and seabirds.
On the Admiralty Audubon Society's webpage, Jerry Gilbert told of his recent bird walk at Cotai Lagoon. While looking for the barred owl that had been reported there by others, he saw a long-eared owl. This is, in fact, a new bird to add to the Cotai bird list. I'm actually not familiar with the long-eared owl, so I looked it up on the Cornell University's All About Birds website, and there was this lovely description. Long-eared owls are lanky owls that often seem to wear a surprised expression thanks to long ear tufts that typically point straight up, like exclamation marks.
2 weeks ago, when Monica Fletcher was on Nature Now talking about the Christmas bird count, she reported the first ever sighting of a Bohemian waxwing in Jefferson County. Last week, Paula Vanderheul and Artemis Selt saw a Bohemian waxwing, part of a large flock of cedar waxwings and American robins foraging on the red berries of the holly trees in the area.
And even in the bitterly cold weather last week, Wendy Feltham has been hanging out on the docks where she has encountered a mystery. A strange type of feather duster worm that even has the expert stumped as to just what species it is, or is it even a feather duster worm at all? You can follow the mystery on the iNaturalist website and see if the specialist can figure out what it was. I did talk to Wendy this morning. She is planning to go back and try to get some more photographs.
Weather watcher Al Latham of Chimicum sent Nature Now an email recently with the following summary information about 2016's weather. The rainfall precipitation in our area for 2016 totaled 47.4 inches. That is 12.5 inches higher than the 36-year average, and December 2016 was actually pretty dry, with 1.8 inches compared to the average monthly rainfall of 5.8 inches. Al notes that NOAA's long-range forecast for January through March 2017 is for cooler and wetter than average weather. Thanks to Al for the observations. Listeners are invited to communicate their observations and comments to us via our email address, naturenow@kptz.org.
So now let's go on to our conversation with Jim Bodkin. Jim recently retired to Port Townsend after a long and impressive career with the federal government as a research wildlife biologist in Alaska with the U.S. Geological Survey. Jim is an expert on coastal marine ecology, marine conservation, and population biology and ecology of marine mammals, especially sea otters. Part one of my interview with Jim about sea otters off the Washington coast aired first here on KPTZ on December 14th, 2016. You can hear the podcast of that program at kptz.org nature.org/podcasts. Jim is such a fascinating person to talk with that what I had planned to be one program quickly evolved to two programs, and we even talked about sea otters and climate change. Let's hear that conversation. Well, we're back with Jim Botkin. As a quick review, we talked a lot about the rafting behavior of the sea otters, the reintroduction of the sea otters off the coast after their destruction of the population as a result of the fur trade. And we talked about how successful this reintroduction has been off the Washington coast over the nearly 50 years since they were brought from the Aleutians down to the Washington coast. And we ended up the last time chatting a bit about just actually how a population expands its range, given that these are creatures who have relatively small home ranges, and they're very loyal to those ranges. So we were talking a little bit about that. I think, if I remember correctly, Jim, you said the current sort of range of distribution of the population is sort of Cape Flattery to the Ho River. Is that about right?
That's about right, yeah. Maybe a little bit towards Nia Bay on the
sort of
straits,
around the tip a little bit.
A little bit, but not much.
And we think close to 2,000 animals from a starter point of maybe a dozen.
Maybe a dozen or two at the most.
So thinking about that home range for a minute, what do you think is likely to happen? Are they likely to continue extending that range? Do you think it'll come into the Straits or maybe even in as far as the San Juan Islands or Puget Sound?
I think it's fairly safe to say that the population of sea otters in off the Washington coast will continue to expand, increase in abundance, and increase in their distribution. I think there's good evidence right now that there's been some exchange of animals with Vancouver Island. There's been some sightings of some tagged animals across the Straits of Juan de Fuca in between those Vancouver Island and the Olympic Peninsula. I expect that we will continue to see increase. There's always the possibility of something unanticipated occurring that could limit and restrict that expansion. Mm-hmm. But given the availability of unoccupied and suitable habitat, I fully expect that someday we'll see sea otters, at least in the Straits. And there's pretty good records of sea otters in the Gulf Islands and in the San Juan Islands. Now,
prehistoric records.
Yeah, prehistoric records. And we occasionally have sightings of them now in the Straits of Georgia. And there's occasional sightings in Puget Sound as well.
And when you talk about suitable habitat, they're near shore mostly.
Right.
Because they dive for food that they can get from the bottom. You mentioned earlier that they don't really particularly need protected areas. And they do need kelp beds, right?
They don't need kelp beds. They can occur in areas where kelp surface.
Oh, really? Because I always just associate them with,
right.
And I know the business about the interaction as a keystone species with the kelp, but they don't need the kelp beds.
Right. There's places in Alaska where canopy-forming kelps are rare or don't occur. Mm-hmm. And sea otters seem to do fine in those types of habitats. They will seek sheltered areas for resting.
Sure.
When it's available. But they're perfectly capable of resting out in open waters. There's populations in the Bering Sea that extend 80 miles offshore into the Bering Sea.
Interesting, because I guess I'd always associated the kelp as when they're resting, they'll kind of wrap a frond of kelp around them and sort of the tether, but they don't really need that.
They don't need it. I think they prefer it. If it's available, they'll use it. And it also serves as kind of a focal point for resting. In fact, some of the places where they occur, we see they rest in the same kelp beds for years after year. And again, it's part of that high fidelity to a specific site. And so they serve as a focal point, but they're not essential. It's not essential habitat.
That's fascinating because I was just in the process of formulating some sort of theory in my mind about why we don't see more of them in Puget Sound. And I was thinking, well, it could be the kelp. It's a different species of kelp in Puget Sound than it is on the open coast. That's a completely bogus theory then, isn't it?
I'm afraid so.
It's bogus. Okay. So talk with me a bit about, I sort of mentioned the role of sea otters in a kelp community and the notion of sea otters being keystone species. I think we talked about this, many, many sessions ago, but can you just kind of briefly summarize that for listeners again?
So there's a fairly straightforward relationship between the diet of the sea otter and urchins and the kelps. And when sea otters are removed from the systems, the urchin, which is a grazer and is quite capable of simply consuming the kelp to the point where it's gone, and we end up with what we call an urchin barrens. Urchins are abundant. They're large. Kelps are absent. And many of the kelp-associated species are also absent.
Which is, you know, there's a rich community of critters.
A very rich and diverse community, right, that's focused around that kelp forest, which is essentially one of the dominant source of primary productivity in the nearshore marine ecosystems. Mm-hmm. It's supplemented. There's a phytoplankton, and the kelps or the macroalgaes are the two sources of primary production in the system. But in this nearshore system, it's really dominated by the kelps, providing that primary productivity. And as sea otters reoccupied habitat throughout the North Pacific, and this has been observed virtually everywhere we've looked, one of their preferred prey items happens to be the sea urchin. And they're primarily consuming the gonads of these, of these urchins. And they're quite capable of removing 99.9% of the urchins in these marine habitats. They don't eliminate them from the system, but they remove that grazing pressure that the urchins exert on the kelps. And what we've seen is that as otters reoccupy habitat, they eliminate the urchins and these kelp forests flourish. And it's not only the canopy-forming kelp surface, but there's also a diverse understory, much like the forest, the terrestrial forest that we see, where there's layers of primary producers in the system. And so these nearshore areas have understory kelps, and then they'll have these canopy-forming kelps. And then it is these canopy-forming kelps that the otters will frequently rest in.
So the diversity and health of a kelp-based ecosystem is absolutely dependent on there being sea otters.
We can have kelp forests in the absence of sea otters, and there's great examples of that along the coast of Southern California and elsewhere. And so there's other predators that can influence the abundance of urchins, as well as physical factors, and there's also the disease in the urchins that can temporarily reduce those populations. But it really is the otters that have that stabilizing effect, and we've seen it over long periods of time. And we've seen kind of this fundamental increase in the biomass of kelps as a result of the removal of the urchins and the persistence of that effect by otters over time, which we haven't seen in those other areas. In other words, those other types of processes that affect kelps can be more ephemeral.
And I was also then doing the terrestrial forest analogy, saying, I suppose you could craft an argument that sea otters play a role with reducing some of the impacts of climate change if they're keeping the kelp forests healthy and the trapping carbon. And I'm making this up here, but
no, you're not.
No, you're not.
I was just going to say you either keep up with the marine ecology literature quite well.
No, I don't.
Very, very astute, but in fact, a friend and colleague, Jim Estes, and some other colleagues published a paper a few years back that quantified the effect of otters on the sequestration of CO2 in the kelps.
Wow.
And determined that in these kelp forests, there was a huge impact on the removal of CO2 by these kelps. So the otters really are having a dramatic
really
effect.
That's really interesting. My mind goes off in other directions, and it's now thinking, how do we make certain that these populations continue to be healthy, and how do we, as a society, protect them?
There's a fair body of laws governing the protection of sea otters as well as other marine mammals and other kind of marine habitats that go back for centuries. The 1911 International Fur Seal Treaty being one early piece of legislation that afforded some protection to sea otters as well as fur seals. More recently, there's been legislation in the form of the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
And that was in the
70s. 1977. And then there's the Endangered Species Act. mm-hmm. which at least two populations of sea otters are now listed under.
Is the population off Washington Coast listed?
It's not listed under the federal, the ESA.
Okay, yeah.
It's not listed as a species under the ESA in Washington. The two ESA-listed populations are California, and then that now the southwest stock of Alaskan sea otters is listed as threatened.
Interesting. And is that because of the oil spills?
That was because of predation by orca, by killer whales.
Oh, really?
Some 80,000 sea otters have been lost from the Aleutian Islands since the early 1980s. Populations are now probably just a single-digit percentage of their historical abundance. And that extends from the kind of the western Alaska Peninsula all the way across the Aleutians.
Hmm.
So a very large-scale decline that's been attributed to predation.
So do we see that kind of predation going on down here?
We don't. We don't see it anywhere else.
And that we would be talking about the transient orcas or the bigs.
Correct.
Yeah.
We do see orca predation on sea otters occasionally in places like southeast Alaska and in places like Prince William Sound where the populations are stable or growing. It's a rare occurrence, and it doesn't seem to be having any impact on the rate of change in the populations.
Of course, now I want to ask, well, does that mean that the orcas are displacing their feeding habits because of something else going on? But that takes us down another whole path.
And it is kind of a controversial hypothesis, but it does relate back to ultimately to the human impacts resulting from industrial whaling in the last century and the removal of large numbers of great whales from the North Pacific and orca predation. Then moving on to the pinnipeds, the seals and the sea lions, and eventually moving into sea otters.
That sort of shift to the smaller animals as the larger ones were less.
Now, and this is a controversial theory about the linkages of these events, but I don't think there's much controversy now about the role that killer whales have had on the decline in sea otters in southwest Alaska.
From the perspective of resource management, are the federal or state agencies actively doing anything to manage these species?
There's the protections, largely against harvest.
So enforcements against harvest or other kinds of takings.
There's protections in the form of federal and state legislation to protect habitat, marine habitats. There's marine sanctuaries. There's marine protected areas. There's policies and legislation for protecting air and water. All of that legislation has the effect of protecting sea otters, as well as all of the species that occur in those types of habitats. There's harassment. The Marine Mammal Protection Act in particular, as well as the Endangered Species Act, limits the amount of indirect
interaction
behavior or harassment that we can have on sea otters and specifically marine mammals in general.
So I'm going to ask one more question. If I wanted to just observe the sea otters off our coast, where would be a good place or places to go and look?
It's a really challenging place to observe sea otters. The seafloor off the coast of west coast of Washington, off the Olympic Peninsula, has a very gradual slope. And so sea otters can occur typically fairly far offshore. I mean, beyond the kind of the tens of meters or hundreds of meters that you might want to look at them closely. There are places where you can see otters. The boardwalk that leads out to Cape Flattery. If you go out there, there's a chance that you can see otters there. In and around Nia Bay, still, there's a few animals that occur in that vicinity. If you walk out through the Olympic National Park out to the coast on those boardwalks that go out there, places out to Cape Alava Sandpoint, and you have binoculars, it would be helpful.
You can find the possibility there.
Right.
Well, again, Jim, this has been delightful. Thank you for talking with me about sea otters again.
It's my pleasure. I enjoy coming and sharing
with
you.
But now let's go back to the mystery sound. That was the wing whistle of surf scoters in flight. Surf scoters are large, stocky, black sea ducks common during our winters here in Port Townsend. The male has a very distinctive head. It's got one or two white patches on the head and another one on the back of its neck. No white on the wings and an oversized, swollen bill. The bill is patterned with white and red and yellow and black. From a distance, it appears mostly orange. Do see if you can find a photograph online of the surf scoter. There are some wonderful head-on shots of this weird duck and his bill. Looking forward towards the next week or so, Charlie, can you help share some upcoming events?
The Jefferson Land Trust and the Cedar Root School are partnering to present a presentation aimed to help understand the mountain lions or cougars living right here in the rural landscape of Jefferson County. On Friday, January 13th, Mark Elbrock will speak about the social lives of large cats and the dilemma of how humans can live alongside these magnificent predators. The talk at the Old Nordland Church Community Hall is limited by the space available, so please contact either the Cedar Root School or the Jefferson Land Trust for more information.
And on January 14th and 15th, the North Olympic Salmon Coalition, along with the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe, will be planting nearly 2,000 native trees and shrubs on the Dungeness River at a site owned by the tribe. The site lacks vegetation and is in need of reforestation to improve water quality on the Dungeness River. Check the North Olympic Salmon Coalition website for more information about volunteering to help.
Join the Friends of Fort Worden for a winter bird walk with Port Townsend naturalist Ken Wilson. The walk will be low-key and informal. The winter bird walk is part of a new Sundays in the Park program offered quarterly by the Friends of Fort Worden State Park. Check their website for more information.
And celebrate and honor the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King on Monday, January the 16th, by participating in a day of service sponsored by the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, the Friends of Fort Worden, AmeriCorps, and the Washington State Park Department. It's an especially important time to remember Dr. King's belief that, and I love this quote, "Everybody can be great because anybody can serve." Check the Marine Science Center's website for more information on this volunteer event.
On January 17th, the Jefferson Land Trust encourages folks to help reforest a clear cut so that water draining into Snow Creek remains clean and cold for salmon and other wildlife. Snow Creek is a salmon-bearing stream that flows into Discovery Bay.
And on the evening of Tuesday, January 17th, Patrick Loafman, Olympic National Park field biologist, will be talking about his 20-year experience botanizing in the Olympic National Park. This program is presented by the Native Plant Society. Check their website for details. And as a preview, Nature Now's Deborah Kelso will be interviewing Patrick on the January 25th show. That's it for this episode of Nature Now. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic and eclectic news and information about the natural community where we live. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas, or even if you think you might be interested in joining our team of Nature Now hosts. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTZ on Thursdays at 5 p.m. and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Recent podcasts are also available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Closing music is by KT Tunstall performing Silent Sea.
Winds are whipping waves up like skyscrapers.